For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. For more information, visit faith.yale.edu.
Historically, the word Christian is supposed to have meant Christ-like. And it seems to me as if that should always be recognized as an aspiration, not a sociological category. It should also be thought of, I think, as an aspiration that we all fall short of, cannot claim. And I think that there are things that we as Christians should recognize in ourselves and have antibodies toward, things like hatred and resentment and competitiveness that is destructive, and making divisions among people that would imply relatively deficient, you know, sacredness or humanity on parts of disfavored groups. I think that any nationalism that claims to be Christian is probably not Christian.
This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. This is a political moment characterized by stridency, suspicion, resentment, anger, and despair, where shared commitments to truth, debate, free speech, and simple good faith in one another, and these core elements of democratic society, these are under threat of outright rejection by those in power. But the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and essayist Marilynne Robinson sees an opportunity for putting aside the resentment, suspicion of the other, and despair, and instead renewing a love of democracy, grounded in the sacredness of the person. And she sees more hope in a patriotism closer to familial love than America First Christian nationalism. Marilynne very graciously agreed to join us for an interview with Miroslav Volf, for a very timely and yet very timeless conversation. She's the author of the beloved Gilead series and numerous essays on politics, culture, and human life in general. Miroslav and Marilynne discuss how to live faithfully in this political moment. Thanks for listening.
So Marilynne, it's so wonderful to have this conversation with you. Welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice.
You know, I have read in this wonderful piece that New Yorker did recently about you, that you, after college, applied to study theology, but that you were unable to do so because you didn't receive any scholarship.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I could have done it. I read omens, you know. There was some sort of fellowship being offered to people at Brown, and I was supposed to write an essay for it. I did all that, and I thought it was quite a good essay. But they thought they had found a better essay. I came in second, and I took this to be a sign that I should do something else. I was looking for anything to tip me off, you know? So it wasn't a sort of hardship thing. It was reading the signs.
I think that administrators should have taken more care to read that application. And I can just imagine if there are any of them are living right now saying to themselves, oh my God, what have we done? We could have had Marilynne Robinson as our graduate and as a theologian. That would be amazing.
Well, you know, at that time, there was not any very friendly place for women in anything theology related, you know? That was also a consideration. I felt as if I were in a larger world by going to plain old graduate school. And
yeah, it may have served you well. It hasn't served theology as well as it has served you, but excellent. So I will tell my dean, because he's trying to raise funds for scholarships for students. This is a great line. You may be missing future Marilynne Robinson as a student of theology. So I don't know whether that's going to attract people to us or it's going to detract and say, well, we'll rather have Marilynne Robinson do what Marilynne Robinson does.
Well, at least I kept reading on my own, and I don't regret that. I mean, I have my own reactions to things, I think can be a very good thing.
That's really, really wonderful. We'll come also to some of the theological themes, but I thought of starting our conversation with your piece that you did for New York Times, where a subtitle of the piece is "This Country is Not an Idea, It's a Family." And so I'd like to start by exploring a little bit more this idea of family. And later on in the essay, you mentioned also home. And this idea of home has been a very important in recent years for me. And in fact, right now I'm writing a book on world as a home of God. And then home in this, both in a material and in social sense, and from family or private homes to even global, biospheric, if you want, home. So this idea of home is really, really important. And it has been, to my chagrin, maybe, important also to the new European right, as they kind of push back on preserving kind of the home and homeland of Europe, right? So you can see already here tensions. And so when you write of America's family as a home, you certainly don't mean of it as kind of some idyllic and happy space. Few families are such, and few homes are such, and you've explored waywardness, tensions, uncertainties, as well as intimacies and kind of positive resonances of home in your novels very well. So when you speak of America as a family, you have some kind of belonging in you. Can you say more about the nature of that belonging?
Well, you know, I think that there's a kind of, you know, there's an arbitrariness that Americans tend not to be comfortable with, you know? I mean, in the sense that if I were to say, I love my mother more than I love your mother, it would be no reflection on your mother. It's simply the fact that, but the word my is a sort of a web that draws together all sorts of things, you know? And I love and I'm very loyal to the fact that this country is an omnium gatherum, you know, that people can apply the word my to it in all sorts of ways and so on. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and make a profound claim on its loyalty to them and so on in that basis. I think that we have, you know, people, not us especially, I mean, as you were saying, the European right also, They make a great effort to find a defining membership. You know, you have to be of a certain this and a certain that, you know. I think that we have the very good historical fortune of having people be able to make the claim on us rather than our defining them, you know. Mm-hmm. And it makes a sort of, you know, a very interesting country that continuously, you know, enlarges or should enlarge its conceptual basis and all the rest of it, you know, just because of all the, you know, cultures and literatures and all the rest of it that we can absorb.
So it's kind of an expansive and expanding notion of family. But you draw, and. You draw radical conclusions from this. In this essay, you say a family should take practical steps to ease one another through hard times, to preserve the integrity of home as a special refuge. What does that mean concretely for you, this easing others in time of hardship?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, most of us have either had difficulty or know people who have everybody has difficulty, right? I think that there's a tendency in this particularly painful period in our history to talk about, you know, things like losers and so on, you know, that to bring that kind of standard to bear as if you had to vie for the status of member of a family, when in fact, if a family's healthy, that's never an issue, you know. I mean, I have a lot of contempt for this this idea that people can, you know, fail in a way that makes them contemptible. It's just, you know, Mozart. I mean, how many how many people of massive talent have in fact sort of died of malnutrition. You know, I mean, that the world is not just. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that we can create justice, we do it generously by refusing to make judgments of that kind, you know.
Right. And you root the family not in Blut und Boden, as you spoke earlier. It's not territorial, or it's not based on blood relations or familial in that sense. You don't also, I take it, and that's where I want to maybe ask you, you don't also root it in the common cultural heritage, right? It's folks from various parts of the world have come to this country. And you speak about human beings being sacred and therefore equal, and then suggests that this sacredness and equality of people, if we would just let them, they would make out of us a family. So how does that work? How does sacredness of human beings create family out of us?
Well, you know, we are a radical departure from the order of things in the universe, we human beings. You know, I mean, there are all sorts of marvelous things that exist that have been created, nothing like us. This incredible capacity for, you know, for creativity and honor and love and all the things that human beings are capable of, that you single them out, you know. I think that we should be able to recognize these things in one another. Even if they're not visible to us, we should know that they're implicit there, you know, in the sacredness of the human being. I think that, you know, when you literacy and vernacular languages and so on, passing through the world, and these amazing, you know, sort of geniuses rising out of the possibility of access to knowledge that they had never had before and so on. I think that you can extend that indefinitely, illimitably. And I mean, another thing that's a great sadness to me is that it seems more and more as if there's a sort of economic rationing of education. All this talk of elites and so on that seems to imply that they are a closed caste that other people can't aspire to and all the rest of it. Everything that militates against our capacity for recognition in one another of the incredible singularity of a human being, that's just a loss and a crime and something that basically will recoil against us at some point.
And this kind of sacredness also, in a sense, has a claim on us, right? Us not just to be honored and respected in a sense, its integrity respected, but actually given for its fragility to be nurtured, to be kept in and possibly enhanced in its sacredness and uniqueness.
Yes. And we know, I mean, you know, I mean, I have through the whole, you know, feminist thing up to this moment. And I know how easily people were talked out of their capabilities and their interests and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a friend in college who was at the head of her class in applied mathematics and couldn't get a recommendation because her professor told her that women don't belong in mathematics. You know, I mean, things like that. The landscape is littered with things like that, you know. And, you know, then they say, well, where are the great women mathematicians? So, you know, but people can be themselves deprived of confidence in a way that is disabling to them, you know. Yeah. And so when we don't treat people with respect, we are impoverishing them, even, you know.
Yeah, and you refer here to all sacredness of all human beings, not particular kind of human beings. It's a moral vision of a human family as a whole. Now, we're living at a time of re-entrenching, of building walls, of concerns for ourselves. We're living in a time America First project. How does this pan-human sacredness relate to America First project?
Well, I can't accept the terms America First in the way that they're presented and intended by Donald Trump. You know, I mean, he's very effectively extinguishing everything exceptional about America, and then, you know, waving flags as he does it. You know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this country is an interesting project, an interesting experiment, and you know, it deserves, you know, care and you know, enjoyment. We could enjoy it if we tried and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't, again, it's like my mother and your mother, you know.
Yeah.
The fact that you want to enhance your own country doesn't disparage any other country in any way.
Yeah, and in some sense, right, it's a version, right, of the Christian, for Christian idea of special relations. Maybe we attend to our family in a special way because we have a deeper ties, more capacity for good, more capacity for ill as well. And so it is with various levels of our special relations. And the nation can be such form of special relations, which does not exclude other people as objects of our love and objects of our care. I take it that's implied in this idea of sacredness of human beings. Now, how do you stand in this regard to the kind of the project of Christian nationalism? Now, I know that you like Puritans quite a bit, John Winthrop, and you and I had this interesting conversation, which we just part of it at a New York City library, where I declared my greater predilection for political stances of Roger Williams, and you've been faithful in many ways to John Winthrop. Can you speak about this kind of Christian nationalism, which many in evangelical conservative circles want to, in a sense, reclaim America as a Christian nation, and that becomes a certain political project for them. Can you say something about that?
Well, you know, I think, you know, historical context is pretty much everything. You know, these people, you know, who washed up in Massachusetts, which is not where they intended to wash up, who were aware of the fact that earlier attempts to establish colonies like theirs had destroyed in Florida and in Brazil, you know, that they were a very small community with, you know, the French Empire looming above them. And, you know, and they were the people who would have been on the anti-royalist side in the revolutions in England, you know. So they were a very small group that grew much smaller after the first winter, you know. And they necessarily, I mean, this is the kind of thing that develops very high identity among groups. Mm-hmm. I think they had absolutely no idea at that point that they would be more than a colony attempting to hold some sort of foothold in the world, you know. I think it's a huge error that people make when they project subsequent history on this, you know, frail little accidental settlement, you know. Winthrop talks about the city on a hill, but what, you know, what he says is people will be watching us because they were a radical social order at the time. And you don't congratulate yourself for the fact that you cannot be hid when you feel that you are in peril of population.
In this kind of setting of very diverse groups of folks. And by the way, we have asked some of our audience members to pose questions. And one of those questions concerns Christian nationalism, and specifically how that Christian nationalism might fit, or how the notion of America then might fit with the diversity of population, religious traditions. There are many religious and our religious people as well in this country.
I mean, it is true that there are many people that call themselves Christian in this country. I find that, I mean, if nationalism means taking care of the particular garden you have been placed in, that's fine. If it means hostility or competitiveness toward others, then it's obviously not Christian, you know? Historically, the word Christian is supposed to have meant Christ-like. And it seems to me as if that should always be recognized as an aspiration, not a sociological category. It should also be thought of, I think, as an aspiration that we all fall short of, cannot claim. And I think that there are things that we as Christians should recognize in ourselves and have antibodies toward, things like hatred and resentment, and competitiveness that is destructive, and making divisions among people that would imply relatively deficient, you know, sacredness or humanity on parts of disfavored groups. I think that any nationalism that claims to be Christian is probably not Christian.
You have this wonderful conversation that you had with President Obama, or actually the other way around, that he had with you. I was so fascinated that he offered for you the designation of a theologian, which he then qualified as somebody who cares a lot about Christian thought. I'll take both of those as synonymous, and so it's wonderful in that regard to claim you as part of our tribe. But one of the things that he did there, and that the two of you did in that interview, is he connected your interest in Christianity with your concern about democracy. And I take it that continues to be your concern, especially in the last 5 years. We have seen increasingly how democracy has lost on reputation for various reasons. And one can say that in some ways democracy is in crisis. And that's not just because of an authoritarian president. It's because various reasons, but also in particular, young people seem not to care particularly much for democracy. They're interested more in achieving certain ends than in the means by which those ends are achieved. And as I was listening and thinking about that, it reminded me of the days after the downfall of Soviet Union, when Russia was going through a certain kind of economic also crisis. And the question was, what's going to happen with democracy? And when I talked to some of my friends there, you know, most people, they said, think, you know, if we are going to choose between bread and democracy, we're going to choose bread. Right now, some people might think, well, if we need to choose between prosperity and democracy, we're going to choose prosperity. And if we need to choose between whatever it is, that's what we are going to choose, as if democracy were not a value in its own right. So could you speak about your interest in democracy, what democracy, not just in what democracy can achieve?
First of all, and this is not anything that describes my love of democracy, that we are now, as all our politicians tell us, the wealthiest culture that ever lived on Earth. We have a history of, you know, a democracy to the degree that this thing has been achieved, that made us richer and richer and richer through generations of time. Now, if people feel that they are so hard pressed materially that they're going to throw over this great historical project, we are in trouble, because that really, that's very unadmirable, you know. As far as democracy itself is concerned, I think that from moment to moment, from person to person, there's a capacity for great insight, for great integrity, and so on. Not in any of us consistently, but overall, if we're attentive to each other, we have those things to learn from each other and to be guided by. There is no other way of trying to tap this potential that exists in human beings other than democracy.
Right. It's a form of also deliberating about our common project, shaping it together, but also that project itself is a project of deliberation. I can just think of wonderful conversations that happen and exchanges that happen that are fruits of democracy, or at least of kind of stances at a maybe smaller scale that we might want to foster at a larger scale in democratic politics.
Mm-hmm. I think that we have to try to give other people grounds for optimism. I mean, you know, usually when your opinion is solicited by the general, you know, by the practices of democracy, you should be taking care that you have something of value to offer, I think. You know, we tend to slight that side of democracy.
Hmm. What do you think are the kind of cultural conditions of democracy? I know democratic functioning is dependent on many things. Some of them have to do with the way political institutions are set up. Others have to do about how our economy is set up, maybe educational system. But there are also kind of more narrowly cultural values that have to be nurtured for democracy to be healthy.
I think that's true. I think that... But again, you know, when you look at old books that are about American democracy, the assumption was clearly present that we have to be sure that people have adequate historical understanding, for example, you know, that they, you know, that basic education is made available at the widest possible sort, you know, so on. We haven't looked. We act as if democracy were just a slightly more complicated way of drawing straws or something, when in fact the assumption behind it is that the society will acculturate people to feel that they have soundly based opinions and that they are free to express them.
But even earlier, I agree. So it's a kind of a nurturing discerning judgment and the mind in terms of through education and other means, but I'm just wondering also about presumably something like a sense that human beings are in whatever way sacred. Maybe everybody won't express it in terms of sacredness, but that they demand our respect. And so it seems to me that anything that undermines the respect for each individual person. Today, we think of the discourse that we're gotten used to, where we have this barrage of disfemisms that are unleashed upon, especially once adversaries. They're monsters. They're animals. It reminds me of earlier vocabulary during Nazi Germany. They're all vermin, and similar things you had in Rwanda. Whenever you have these strong conflicts, people tend to want to dehumanize other human beings, let alone hold them as sacred. And okay. So what do you think, what are our resources to have folks return back to holding one another sacred? Okay. Which is a condition of us being truly a family.
Well, you know, we have a lot of very wonderful stuff historically to turn back to. I mean, you know, these people that I read, people like Ames and Flavel and so on, they talk continuously about human gifts, human capacities, kind of like Pico della Mirandola or so, and they believe. Mm-hmm. It's an anthropology of the brilliance of humankind, you know? Yeah. And I think that the that, you know, a great deal that was, you know, liberal, that was full of promise for future societies and so on, came out of that theological view, which is not, it's not about, you know, angels and devils. It's about conscience and consciousness and the senses and, you know.
One of the questions one of our audience members had is, what do you think is the relationship between kind of structural change and a moral transformation? It seems that from some circles, at least, the structural change is given strong primacy. On the other side, you have obviously the other side, which simply think that moral transformation as such is sufficient, or at least has primacy. What's your take on that?
Frankly, our recent history has not interested us to believe that people are accurate in their appraisal of their own morality. I mean, one of the things that drives me crazy is that many of the deprivations that are structural in the society that are people resist any change because, you know, it's supposed to build your character to be insulted and injured. I don't, you know, I do not share a definition of morality with people who take that view, even though they routinely present themselves as being the moralists, you know. I think we have to have a much better, much more humane and considered definition of morality before we even try to apply it beyond ourselves as standards. And of course, anyone can herself or himself be more or less as moral as he or she chooses to be. There's nobody intruding on that.
Some 20 years ago, you wrote, I miss civilization and I want it back.
From the heart. You know, that was my mother's favorite sentence out of everything that I wrote.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's, well, that speaks well of your mother. It's yes, beautiful. It's so succinct and has a inner beauty and power at the same time. So I think you referred there to, I want to overhear passionate arguments about what we are and what we are doing and we ought to do. I want to feel that art is an utterance made in good faith by one human being to another. Those are kind of the lines that I think precede, I miss civilization and I want it back. So is this about, partly about what we talked earlier, about seeking truth in conversations, kind of some kind of a weight of importance? What were you pushing against or what were you longing for when you were missing civilization?
You know, one thing, I mean, many things, but one thing, the terms in which we understood our own civilization or our own culture, just to avoid confusion, it became very harsh. And you hear this, you know, I mean, and again, I'm talking about within the terrain of my, you know, identification. People began saying, you know, Americans only care about money. Americans do resist education. Americans this, Americans that, you know. And there was always this sort of implied but never identified ideal other of whom these things were not true. I mean, you know, if you're going to make comparisons, you have to understand that there have to be two terms at least to the comparison, right? I mean, what it usually came down to is that, you know, if you imagine somebody living life perfectly, you would not find an American who did that. True, you know. But there's a way in which we have undermined the cultural seriousness of much that we do, films and television, all sorts of things, because we have this idea that we're basically, you know, feeding mice to snakes or something, you know, which is not civilization.
I think about democracy and the almost the attitude that I perceive, that I sometimes detect in myself. If truth is against me, why should I be for the truth? So that kind of truth is kind of instrumental way of relating to the world, but not something that ought to be honored at one's own expense. Do you think something of that sort is essential to democracy for us to retrieve the value of truth qua truth?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, I think that many things would enhance our capacity for democracy. Courtesy.
Yeah.
You know, because courtesy, I mean, at least in its best expressions, does not distinguish courtesy toward anyone as courtesy toward anyone else, you know. Yeah. And this is something that makes people available to one another, as, you know, it establishes a certain level of trust, which we, God knows, sorely lack now, you know. And, you know, I mean, I think, I'm just talking over the top of my head, but I think that if we sat down and thought about it, we'd find all kinds of ways to enhance democracy, putting a huge value on personal ethics being one.
Right. When you spoke about courtesies, obviously this is kind of almost like Victorian morality, and sometimes is looked down upon. But it's a very important moral component to it that requires honoring. One of my favorite lines, I think, must be favorite command in the entire Bible, and it has only two words, and it comes from 1 Peter.
And honor, reads, everyone.
Honor everyone. Bravo, bravo. but it seems to me, even if one wants today to honor everyone, that we're partly losing resources to do so. And here's what I mean by that. I think honoring everybody presupposes a fundamental distinction between person who ought to be deemed sacred and ought to be honored as something of incomparable worth, and what they do, and even what kind of character they have, which is what we evaluate, which is what we say it's a lesser or a greater value, which can be excellent, which can be debased. But I find, and I want to see how you respond to that. I'm not sure that we make that distinction readily. I mean, it's baked in. It's a foundational stone of Luther and foundational stone of Calvin, right? Mm-hmm. This distinction between the two. But today somehow we push against it, and then suddenly honor everybody becomes very difficult. How can I honor somebody who is acting in dishonorable ways?
Well, that's a very interesting problem. But I mean, I think that we always have to fall back to the position that Christianity asks us to do things that seem on their face impossible. You know, love your enemy and so on. So the fact that it's impossible is not disqualifying. But at the same time, I think we have special problems now, a kind of recurrence of something that has happened historically in the West. I think something like, I was reading some of these QAnon theories, I mean, you know, memes, whatever they are. And they really, really are reminiscent of like the blood libel in the period before the Second World War, where they create a horrific image that I think probably has a different kind of place in the nervous system than something that you would think of as a reported fact. Or, you know, they put discourse outside the range of, you know, the probable or the expected, which is the grid that we normally use to appraise human behavior, to know what to assume about someone we do not know, you know. So these things are, I mean, more than anything else, I mean, there are lots of problems, but more than anything else, I think that's what puts the conversation totally out of whack. There is no way to respond to these things, which are, in effect, kind of sick fantasies that people can't forget, you know, and that contaminate the people with whom they are arbitrarily associated.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I sometimes listen about those things, I remember my father was insistent that in his presence, no ill should be said of anybody who isn't present. That did not make for very interesting table conversations, let me tell you. No gossip was allowed. But there's something extraordinary, I think, when I think about it, in a sense that honors the other person, another person's kind of presumptions that they have something to say about themselves, in order to present themselves as they want to be seen, rather than the first impression that I have of them is what I will go with, and I will also twist it to in a more negative way to suit some of my maybe fancy of a nice story that I'm telling, or fancy some power move that I want to make.
I think that also there is in the consciousness that is responsive to these kinds of slanders, there is a kind of demonism, you know, as a part of the construction of the world from their point of view, which means that things are happening that are basically that derive from something outside human interactions. You know? And you know, I mean, again, how do you speak to that? You know, I mean, but it goes right back to witch burning and all the rest of
it. Yeah. But you speak in that interview with President Obama that democracy requires willingness to assume well about people, which means some kind of initial trust, and that trust presumes trustworthiness and therefore some kind of base goodness. Now, you and I come from the tradition which is often accused of having very dour view of humanity, original sin. And I didn't know that about you either, that one of your earliest, the text that turned you toward theology was Jonathan Edwards on original sin. I'll have to read that.
It's about all sorts of things. It's really about time and causality. That's what it's about.
Oh, I see. Well, see, I was just going to say, I've got to read it because I've never read that that text. Where I was headed with this before that digression to Jonathan Edwards, where I was headed with this is that notwithstanding emphasis even on tainedness of human beings, there's kind of more fundamental than this is a kind of primordial goodness of people, notwithstanding that. And when I read your novels, that seems to me to kind of shine through the kind of primordial goodness, notwithstanding the fallenness, frailty, whatever we are, cracked vessels. Can you speak about bearing on this for nurturing democracy?
Well, you know, I myself think of original sin as a brilliant idea because it means that everyone will sin, and it means that I will sin too. Yeah. And that means, and not out of a special viciousness of my own character, but because as a human being, that is my lot, you know? Yeah. So a categorical pardon is built into the idea of original sin. And I think that that's what we need, really. I think that's that's brilliant, you know? Yeah. Part of the reason I like the Puritans is because they, despite this completely groundless reputation they have, they never assume their own purity or their own righteousness. That the whole conceptual model would forbid that.
Yeah, in a sense, it's no accident that original sin ends up being emphasized by the reformers at the same time when the idea of the grace is heightened.
Right.
So the kind of radicality of grace kind of matches the sense of taintedness, inescapable taintedness, and kind of catches it, so to speak, right?
Exactly.
Catches human being and notwithstanding of that. Hmm. But a default stance in many settings, and that's also what you talk about this in this interview about, is a kind of suspicion. Not just mistrust for us, but often suspicion. We approach things, texts often, and also people with the stance of an interrogator. Texts and people are presumed to be guilty until somehow they're proven innocent. And I mean, anybody who looks hard enough will always find something to justify suspicion. You know, I was mildly interrogated when I was back in former Yugoslavia and serving mandatory military service by Secret Service. And they're constantly finding stuff that they could latch onto, and interrogations can go interminably because you can always twist something to make it look as if something mischievous was going on. But how does one return to the stack? How does one see human beings with the eyes of grace, not blind to their foibles and faults, but again as those worthy of our affection and of nurture? Again, how do you relate to the your relation to your character is what it seems like one ought to emulate in ways in which one relates to the concrete people.
Well, I you know, I'm very glad that's true, that you feel that way. I love my
tell us your secret, though. I was not complimenting you simply. That's well known. I want to know your secret.
Well, I love my characters, and frankly, I mean, I'm the dealer in this particular situation. You know,
well, there we go.
And I have to be fair about the fact that the problems that I create don't overwhelm me, but you know. But it's also true, I think, you know, that your good Lutheran Dietrich Bonhoeffer talked about costly grace, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think something that this present era of Christian thought, to the extent that it deserves the name. Sorry. But, you know, that it puts...
You didn't give it a name.
It puts all this into a worldly context, you know, how you have to be suspicious because somebody might intend you harm. You know, you might, you know, that used car dealer might, you know, be about to do something terrible. So you, I mean, of a financial kind. And so you have to this and that, you know. I think that grace, to the extent that we can offer it to one another, can be assumed to come with a cost. You know, I mean, I think that Christianity tells us that in many circumstances, you will come out on the wrong side of the thing. You know, you will get slapped on the other cheek, you know. I mean, how can we claim to be a Christian civilization when we put aside the most compelling and most difficult demands that Christianity makes? And they certainly mean that you honor everyone, even the emperor who probably wants you dead, you know?
It's a challenge. I think that I'm returning back to democracy. It's a challenge that we are presented. We often think of the major issues that we are facing today in the current political moment. Are kind of political challenges of the practical kinds of ways. And I do think that there are really very important challenges. In no way I want to minimize them. For instance, being about healthcare, about respect for people of color, about environment, about economic prosperity, whatever they are. But somehow I've been struck in this era how much our political challenges are challenges about our humanity. What does it mean to be human, and what's worth aspiring to as a human being, and how one lives together as a community with aspiration of truly humane life? And I want to put it in those terms, and somehow it seems like I'm missing when I say it in those terms. It seems does not have hands to receive it.
there are things that we tacitly forbid one another. One of them is to speak seriously about religion. Hmm. One of them is to speak seriously about what is wanted from life. You know, there's a kind of passively coercive quality in the culture that streams you along toward, you know, checking boxes and, you know, having aspirations that are really kind of below your dignity and all the rest of it, I think that if we could simply free the speech that is the voice that is great within us, you would find that there is in the culture a huge craving for that they cannot express a craving for. Teaching young writers, one of the things you have to do is pry them loose from the expectation that there are things they cannot write about because whatever, culture gods, they have not even that specificity. There is just something in the culture whispering in their ears, this would not be cool, this would not be acceptable, you know. And they don't make the test, you know. I'm always telling them, I wrote about a minister dying in Iowa in 1956. how unlikely is that, you know?
Well, that's why I'm asking you this question, right? Because you do it so well in your novels. Many conservative Christians are supporting President Trump. It seems to me that when I observe behavior of and also policies of the president, they far from embodying Christian values, they seem to embody almost like classical pagan values. So if you went, and by classical pagan values, I mean a kind of a paganism of which Nietzsche thought of himself as being kind of retriever in some sense. And the kind of new European right has picked out some of that. There's Alain de Benoist on being a pagan, picks up those values. And Alain de Benoist is one of the key philosophers of the new European right. I mean, that's an emphasis on superiority rather than equality, on glory rather than on service, on heroic victory rather than on sacrifice, on pride rather than humility, on tribe and not human. You can go down the line and you can see the kind of a lineup. That's what's at the forefront. And I'm sometimes thinking, Christians are supporting this. And I'm thinking, is something like paganization of American, especially conservative Christianity going on? And it's a kind of horrible thought to entertain, but it's very hard for me to see how it isn't. Maybe it's instrumental only, maybe it's for time being to achieve something, but it's deeply disturbing.
It is just very deeply disturbing. As far as the, you know, in terms of, you know, our life as a society that, you know, deals with questions of rights and so on, I think one of the major things that has happened in my historical memory, which is long enough, is that people, there's been this great pivot where people in other generations tended to make issues around other people's rights, you know, women's rights, you know, the rights of Black people, the rights of Chinese, all this kind of thing. That people who by definition were not in positions of power are championed by people who are, that turned around, and now everyone is a fairly ferocious defender of his or her own rights, which means that the idea of the culture as an overarching whole is I mean, the idea of the wholeness of the culture is lost. There's also the fact that people, if they can be very touchy about their rights. They can invent rights they nobody ever had before. You know, I grew up in the Mountain West and I virtually never saw a gun. Now, what in the world is this sudden everybody's bristling with armaments because the Second Amendment says so? You can't have a historical reading that history does not support, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, this, now it's gotten to the point where, you know, you can't walk up and put your rifle in the preacher's ear with the Second Amendment should say that I can, you know. This is ridiculous. I mean, we've made ourselves into these hypersensitive autoimmune kind of creatures that think about our own good and transgressions against our own boundaries, and not, you know, we do not talk about problems in a way that would make us the help that other people need. You know?
Yeah. So in a sense, here, the rhetoric of rights in service of what's in it for me, morality or amorality, if you want to put it that way.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you hear these people complaining that their religious freedom is being impinged on, you know, and then you find out what the issue is and you think, well, you know, that's your religion. You live by that religion. Don't take it to the Supreme Court, you know, because there are other rights that would feel infringed on by the expansion of your right. We used to understand that, you know.
Yeah. Well, and it just seems to me, I mean, I suppose I can master some kind of sympathy and then respond in the way exactly that you have. But on the other hand, when I look at the history of Christianity and how much rights of Christians were impinged upon, it seems to me rather thin-skinned or rather frivolous to insist with such ferociousness on those rights, rather than worry, again, as you've said, about rights of so many people in so many places, or rights to non-Christians in this country being trampled upon. So you're a Christian whose thought has been deeply shaped by Calvin, progenitor of Reformed Christianity. And I found out you believe that Martin Luther's chief Reformation tract, Freedom of the Christian, is one of the most beautiful texts in all literature. You said all literature, not just theological literature. This is amazing for me as a person who is a big devotee of very angular and problematic Luther. But, and so that's pretty pretty kind of down to the root Reformation Christianity. But I think you describe yourself, and from what we have now talked about, you describe yourself as a politically liberal. And some conservative Christians might claim that you lost your faith and lost your soul. How can you do that? What's the relation for you between your Christian identity and your political identity?
Well, you know, when I see people blocking, you know, rise in the minimum wage, for example, or all these kinds of, you know, economic things that have been used, or supporting a party that suppresses the vote, or so on, these things offend me religiously. Mm. You know, I feel that my religious freedom to live in a country where people are fed and clothed and the imprisoned are visited and all the rest of it, my right is infringed by other people's insistence that there are higher values than that, which I don't find in the text, frankly. I don't, God knows about my soul. One does what one can. But I find my soul a little safer among my liberal friends than I feel that it would be. In other hands.
So we started with your original intention to enter the ministry, possible theology, And perhaps you can give theologians and ministers some advice. And I mean by that, one of the troubling features of the present present also political moment, is that not only are we losing many young people to faith. America is becoming increasingly secularized, some of that, I suspect, is happening because of the kind of problematic marriage of power and a certain kind of religion in today's environment. I know that to you, as to me, Christian faith means a great deal. And so the big question is, how do we help people retrieve or come in touch, at least, with the beauty of faith, a kind of beauty that shines through many of your characters? What do you think can be done? What would you advise ministers and theologians like me to do?
Well, one thing that I would, I mean, when you look at the reformers, they try to get the full depth of the faith. You know what I mean? They don't, you know, so much of Christianity, it's gone into what it takes to be a kind of survival mode, I think, where it's, it becomes a society of nice people. And nothing is going to be done or said that implies that metaphysics is involved, you know, that the deepest kind of deep thought is sustained by Christian tradition, you know. It's a condescension. And one of the things that I have found out from the way I teach, you know, the way I approach Moby Dick and so on, theology is very beautiful. Metaphysics is very beautiful. People who have never encountered it have no idea what it is and how it resonates through life and through perception and all the rest of it. I think that a great many ministers have to recover the idea that they are teachers, and they're people who are especially equipped, one hopes, to open a conception of the world that no one finds anywhere else. You know, I mean, the culture is maimed by the loss of the capacity in the population to actually talk about these things. You know,
I read that you're working on the book on Christology, and for some time now, I have come to think that Jesus Christ has become a moral stranger to our current Western culture. I almost think almost everything we think is really important wasn't important to him. That was really important to him isn't important to us. Are you going to address that issue in your Christology essays?
Well, I will. I have so many. I was supposed to write a book on the Old Testament too. I don't know in what order all of these visionary books of mine will actually come into the world. But, you know, I was thinking, taking actually a course by Zoom, my church, on the book of Mark. Mm. And that amazing impatience of Jesus with the fact that his disciples don't get it, you know. And you think, well, he is doing something absolutely unique, you know, in the history of Judaism or anything else. How does he expect them to understand? Mm. And then I thought, he expects them to understand the nature of God from the Old Testament, and that the nature of God is the loving shepherd that tends to the sheep, the thing, you know, the God that does not exalt himself in the sense of holding himself apart from humanity and so on. That if they understood the God of Moses, they would understand Jesus. You know, and I think that's a sort of important, you know what I mean? That is the kind of thing that I would take up if I were writing that essay at this moment.
Marilyn, this is very wonderful. We could go on. Thank you very much for taking the time. And I pray the strength to you to finish all those projects that I saw listed there. I need to read every one of them.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I will need all your prayers.
Well, I'm not sure how powerful my prayers are. But it will be a supplication before God.
Thank you.
For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured novelist and essayist Marilyn Robinson and theologian Miroslav Volf. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edited and produced the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. New episodes drop every Saturday, and you can subscribe through any podcast app. We hope you're enjoying the show, and we hope that you'd consider supporting us. Three ways that you can do that are as follows. You can share the show with a friend by text or email, and then I hope you talk about it. You could post it on your social feed, or you could open up Apple Podcasts right now, just after listening, to review and rate the show. Now, we're asking you to share and support us because maintaining human connection is really important these days. We were not meant to live at distance from one another. So we hope this show is just a small, consistent way you can keep connecting, keep growing, keep seeking a life that is worthy of our shared humanity. We'll be back with more this coming week. Thanks, friends.